Let's begin another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through God's inspired holy word by turning back to John chapter number 9 and continue talking about Jesus' confrontation with the Jewish leadership, particularly the Pharisaic leadership in Jerusalem during the Feast of Tabernacles time, 6 months before Jesus' death and resurrection. He had just completed this extended, heated debate about identity with the Pharisees, and he'd concluded it with this idea that he was the I Am, and the Pharisees wanted to stone him to death for blasphemy at that point. And then he left the area of the temple where that debate had happened, probably going from the court of women area into the court of the Gentiles. And I told you that that's where a lot of those who had physical impurities that made it hard for them to work would gather in order to ask for donations, ask for alms from the many hundreds of thousands of worshipers that came through that area each and every week. And so we are told in John chapter 9, verse 1, that as he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. So this man, we'll find out later, he's of majority age, so he's got to be in his 20s or older. He has never been able to see, always blind. So verse 2, his disciples asked him, they want to ask a philosophical question. Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Now that seems a little odd to us to ask about the man himself being the one that caused the blindness when he was a little bitty baby, that is, a fetus inside his mother's womb. But we need to understand the philosophical mindset of the Pharisees. And with that in mind, I thought that we might start with a little something out of Josephus. Josephus was a first century Jewish author. He was himself a Pharisee, and so he knows what Pharisees believe. So in Antiquities of the Jews, book number 18, and let's see, it's also chapter number 1 of book 18, down in subsection number 3. He begins to talk about the belief system of the Pharisees. And this is what he says. Now, for the Pharisees, they live meanly. Now, that's not mean as in they're vicious, but rather controlled, under restraint. They despise delicacies in diet. So they're not like eating a bunch of fancy foods. Very, very straightforward diet. And they follow the conduct of reason. So they believed in the benefits of study and the study of philosophy. And what that prescribes to them as good for them, they do. So whatever it is they feel is good, they feel they need to engage in that. They need to do good. Continuing. They think they ought to earnestly strive to observe reason's dictates for practice. They also pay a respect to such as are in years. So they have respect for their elders. Nor are they so bold as to contradict them in anything which they have introduced. So they don't contradict people older than themselves, except under very extreme circumstances. And when they determine that all things are done by fate, they do not take away the freedom from men of acting as they think fit, since their notion is that it has pleased God to make a temperament whereby what he wills is done, but so that the will of men can act virtuously or viciously. Now, that's the part I wanted to get to. The Pharisees, according to Josephus, and he was one, believed in fate, that everyone was either lost or saved at the time of their conception, at the time of their birth. And that God, of course, was the one that chose that. But they also believed that inside those two categories, the people saved by God's choice and the people not saved by God's choice, that the people had the free will to do as they wish. But that those actions, those free will actions, came with a response from God. So in the case of those that were sinners, they still could choose to do some nice things, which God might actually reward them in this life for, but more likely they would choose to do wrong things, which God would punish them for. And the Pharisees further believed that the things that happened to you in life represented those actions of God. Now I hope you understand why the apostles are asking the question they asked. They are looking at a man here who has been without sight and forced to beg for his living for at least 20 years because he was born blind. And that must be because God did that to him. And if God did it to him, it must be because of sin. And so their question is, was it because of his mom and dad's sin that God punished them by making this baby born blind? Or did the baby himself, in mom's womb, do something, say something, think something that was sinful enough that God struck him with this debilitating condition? Now, I don't believe in fatalism. I believe that everyone is born innocent, just like Adam and Eve, and that everyone has free will to choose what they're going to do with this gift of life. I believe that 1 Corinthians 10:13 applies to everyone, that no temptation has come upon us except that which is common to all mankind. And God is faithful in that he will not permit us to be tempted beyond what we are capable, and with that temptation will provide a way of escape that we may be able to endure it. So I am convinced from Scripture that everyone has the free will to sin, which they do, for all have sinned and fall short of God's glory, and that it's their own fault, my own fault, that I am separated from God and that they are separated from God. And that the things in life may sometimes be a result of my sin choices, but not always. The book of Ecclesiastes talks about there being randomness in certain parts of life. That is, the victory doesn't always go to the strongest army. The race doesn't always go to the fastest person. Circumstances sometimes end up with random effects. We also live in a fallen world. So when we put all of this together, there is no reason to think that a baby born with a debilitating disease was born because they sinned. They couldn't have sinned inside the womb. I just don't believe that. I don't think there's any scriptural reason to believe that. They could have been born with a debilitating disease because of something their parents did, because we know some debilitating diseases are the result of poor choices by parents. Think about crack babies, babies born with other alcohol syndrome, things like that. But sometimes a disease is just random. It might be genetic that just pops up from time to time. Sometimes it might be environmental that just happens to hit the child. So the question that these guys are asking, the second part of it, I think is unjustified. The first part of it, they might think that it's justified. Did mom and dad do something wrong? But Jesus is not going to let them continue in this belief much longer. Verse number 3, Jesus answered, "It is not that this man sinned or his parents." So let's settle that right off the bat. His mom and dad didn't sin, and therefore that's why he's born blind. He didn't sin himself while he was in mom's womb, and that's why he was born blind. So, why? But that the works of God might be displayed in him, meaning he was born blind for some other reason, just the fact that it's in a part of a fallen world. But God is going to use it for his glory. Verse 4, "We must work the works of him who sent me while it's day. Night is coming when no one can work." So Jesus wants them to understand our responsibility is do the best we can with what's in front of us, to do God's work in every opportunity. Think about later writings. Whatever your hands find to do, do all to the glory of God, right? Everything we do, we should be keeping our eyes open to do something for God to benefit from. And God's greatest benefit is to see people saved. Jesus goes on to say, "As long as I'm in the world, I am the light of the world." He'd actually been saying that in the previous context, that he's the one that's bringing God's glory and shining it so that people can come out of darkness. So here's a man that has been in perpetual physical darkness his entire life. And Jesus is wanting to bring the light to him. Not just physically, but spiritually too. And that's what we ought to be doing as well. As long as we have physical capability, we should do things that will bring the light of Jesus to other people. All right, now, verse 6. "Having said these things, he spat on the ground and made mud with the saliva. And then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud." Now the question comes up all the time, why did Jesus do it this way? And my honest answer is, I don't know. There have been some suggestions in the commentaries and things that it was believed that the spit, the saliva of righteous prophets had some supernatural ability. I am hard-pressed to point to any first-century primary resources with that evidence. Other than Jesus, I can't find any. And so I'm not altogether certain that was the case in the first century. But I do know that spit is sometimes used as a ready source of moisture. And so Jesus wants to make mud to anoint the guy's eyes with, because he wants the guy to wash this mud off. So it may be just simple as he needed to spit to make some mud. And if that's the case, I'm fine with that. Let's go on. So he smears this saliva mud on the guy's unseeing eyes. He's never seen with them, remember. And then he gave him a command. He said to him, "Go, wash in the pool of Shalom, which means sent." Now, this is the pool. We've talked about it before. It's on the extreme south end of the city of Jerusalem. I've been there. It's really cool to stand there with this, where this story had taken place. So it was called Siloam because the water had been sent there to this new pool in the days of King Hezekiah from the Gihon Spring, which is about midway up the ancient city of David, the ancient city of Jerusalem, from the Pool of Siloam. Because Hezekiah did not want the water spilling out into the Kidron Valley anymore, where it might be used by besiegers. So he wanted to keep the water inside the walls. So he sent it to a new pool, which was named Sint, or Siloam. Now, Siloam is at the southern end of the pathway of the pilgrims that has just been recently excavated even more in Jerusalem. I'm excited that this October I'm going to get to see another big section of it and walk this path that this man would have walked. But what would happen is many of the people coming to Jerusalem would wash down at the Siloam pool and then walk the steps of the path of the pilgrim up to the Temple Mount and then go up in worship. And so Jesus is at the Temple Mount. He puts the mud on this man's eyes and says, I want you to go and wash this mud off down in the Pool of Siloam, making him go the reverse trip down this path of the pilgrims to the Sint Pool. And so what happens? So he went as he'd been instructed. He washed as he'd been instructed, and he came back to the Temple Mount area being able to see. Now, imagine what that must have been like for him, where he is basically having to depend on his own memory of this Pilgrim of the Pathways, if he'd ever walked it before, or he's depending on people to help him make his way down this path. It's about a tenth of a mile, I think, from the Temple Mount down to the Pool of Siloam. And once he gets down there, he walks down the steps into the pool. It's a big pool. They've only got a small part of it excavated, but it's a massive pool. And he walks down into it, and then he cups water up and brings it to his face and washes off this mud that the guy had put on his eyes. And lo and behold, the moment the mud's gone and he opens his eyes, he can see again. Actually, never before. He can see. And suddenly he is just overwhelmed by the sights of Jerusalem and life. And no doubt he was praising and yelling and all excited, and he makes his way back up the path of the pilgrims, all the way back to the Temple Mount, back to the area where he'd been sitting. And verse number 8 says, the neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, is this not the man who used to sit and beg? He'd been here long enough, at least 20 years. He'd been here long enough that people got used to knowing him. All of us have people that we don't really know, but we pass by them on a regular basis, you know, maybe driving here and there, and they happen to be there all the time. We know who they are. We see them. We're not intimate with them, but we are acquainted with them. That's what's happening here. People who had passed by him, no doubt given him many a coin, they suddenly see him all excited and using his brand new eyes in such a way that they're like, what? What's happened? And some were saying, oh yeah, it's him. Others were saying, no, he just looks like him. And he kept saying, I'm the man, I'm the guy, it's me, it's me. And so he is ecstatic about this new part of his life. And so they said to him, well, how are your eyes opened? How can you see now? And he answered, there was this man called Jesus. He made mud and he anointed my eyes. And then he told me, go to the pool of Siloam and wash. So I went, I washed, I received my sight. And so he is quite happy and excited to share the good news of Jesus and his new sight. And that is definitely where we ought to be, hadn't we? Every last one of us should be ecstatic about how Jesus changed our lives, brought us out of the darkness of sin, brought us into the brilliant light of God. And we should be ready to tell anyone and everyone about the hope of salvation we have, right? And so he's told all this, and they said to him, well, where is he? And he said, I don't know. That was quite a little while ago that Jesus anointed his eyes and sent him off down the path. And so now we've got a problem, because some of the people hearing all of this heard him say, the Jesus guy anointed my eyes with mud and told me to go to the pool and wash. Those activities were counted by the Pharisees as work. To make mud of any sort was work. To smear it on somebody's eyes would have been work. To wash it off would have been work. And so some of these guys are anti-Jesus people. And the moment they hear that, verse 13, they brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Now it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. And so that means we're on the 24th day of the seventh month of this particular Jewish year. It is October the 18th by our calendar, therefore a Saturday. And he, Jesus, has violated the Pharisaic rules about keeping Sabbath. So the Pharisees are now involved in investigating this Jesus violation. Because remember, they have been investing a lot of time and effort in trying to find something they can bring Jesus up on charges for. And now they think they might have it. So the Pharisees again asked him how he had received his sight. And he said to them, he put mud on my eyes, and then I washed, and I see. Some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath. Because, he broke the Pharisaic idea by making mud, But others said, well, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs? That's a good question, isn't it? How could somebody make a man who'd never been able to see, let alone on the Sabbath day? So there was division among them. Jesus has this polarizing effect, doesn't he? So they said again to the blind man, what do you say about him since he opened your eyes? And he said, he's a prophet. And so the Jews did not believe that he'd been blind and had received his sight until they called the parents of the man who had received his sight and asked them, is this your son whom you say was born blind? So the Pharisees are now looking for a way to disprove that this miracle happened. So they call in mom and dad, which means that, again, this man must not be super old, because mom and dad are still around and are looked at as authoritative figures in his life. So they ask the question. Notice that they phrased it in such a way that they're questioning their veracity even before they give their testimony. Is this your son whom you say was born blind? How then does he now see? There might have been already the thought that they could bring this guy and his parents up on charges of cheating people for alms. So their response, his parents answered, oh, we know that this is our son and that he was born blind. And I no doubt would think they were also thinking, and we can prove it. We got plenty of people that can bear testimony that he has never been able to see. Verse 21, But how he now sees, we don't know. Nor do we know who opened his eyes. You ask him. He's of age. He'll speak for himself. Now, when they say he's of age, we know that the age of majority amongst the Jewish people was considered to be age of 20. Because in the Old Testament story of the Exodus, those who were under the 20-year mark were not held accountable by God for the judgment or for the refusal to go into the Promised Land and therefore come under God's judgment of having to die in the wilderness. So 20 seems to be the age of accountability, not too far off from where we count it, not accountability, but a majority. We do usually about anywhere from 18 to 21 years of age. So split the difference and you've got the Jewish idea. So he's over that age and they are telling the Pharisees, you can talk to him. He's legitimate. He can answer his own questions. Now, why? Why did they go that track? Verse 22, John slips in here to remind us of the current situation. His parents said these things because they feared the Jews, specifically the Jewish leadership, the Pharisaic leadership. For the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus to be Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. And therefore, his parents said, he's of age, asked him. So the Jewish synagogues were controlled mostly by the Pharisees. And the Pharisees had put the word out, anyone who dares suggest that Jesus might be this Messiah, they're going to be excommunicated. And if you were excommunicated from the Jewish synagogue, people wouldn't shop at your stores. They wouldn't let you shop at their stores. They wouldn't follow through with marriage contracts. Sometimes divorces would be initiated, things of that nature. Disowning, disinheriting would take place. So the Pharisees are putting the thumbscrews to everybody. And these guys feel it and say, you need to talk to him. He's of age.